Welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from The Atavist, and I'm here with Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer from Long Form, my co-hosts.
Morning, Evan.
It's a rainy day.
Yeah. It's a rainy day morning. We never do this in the morning for probably good reason. Max interviewed Adrian Chen from Gawker this week.
Internet famous Adrian Chen. He has been in the news. You might have read his story about Violent Acres. The greatest troll on the web was the headline, I think. Biggest troll on the web. He was the most influential commenter on Reddit. He was also a moderator on Reddit. He was also responsible for some of the most offensive content on Reddit. And a week and a half ago, Adrian unmasked him on Gawker. And my sense from talking to him was that he has not done anything but respond to responses to this story for the last week and a half.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, this story is a bit of an anomaly in among some of the stuff that Adrian has done that's a little bit less directed at a specific individual. And he's also done a lot of work sort of exploring the mysteries of the internet. I think he tracked down a guy who, I'm sure you guys get into this in the interview.
Yeah, I may or may not have used the phrase internet detective.
But I'm jazzed about something else.
What are you jazzed about, Aaron?
I'm jazzed about our sponsor.
Heyo.
Tiny Letter. Tiny Letter is a simple, minimalist, powerful email newsletter service from the good people at MailChimp. It's really probably the quickest you can go from 0 to 60 in getting a newsletter out, and we recommend it and thank them for the sponsorship.
Thanks, Tiny Letter. All right, here's Adrian Chen. Adrian, thanks for coming to J Street.
Thanks for having me.
So almost a week ago, last Friday, you published a story about, well, why don't you tell us about the story?
Okay. I wrote a story outing a notorious user of the social news site Reddit. His handle was Violent Acres, and he was responsible for some really horrible things, creating sections dedicated to violence against women and posting a lot of creepy pictures of underage girls. And I found out his identity was a 49-year-old Michael Brutsch from Arlington, Texas. And I called him up and confronted him and then published a story kind of outing him and telling the story of how he became such a powerful user of Reddit, which, if you're not familiar with Reddit, is kind of one of probably the single most influential site in internet culture right now. It's got billions of page views a month. It had 4.2 billion page views in August and has become this kind of cultural juggernaut. And,
And Violent Acres was not just a random guy.
Yeah, he was arguably the most influential user of Reddit, which is a completely user-generated site. Reddit is divided into subsections called subreddits that anybody can create. And when you create it, you become a moderator and you have kind of ultimate control over these subreddits. And there are subreddits for everything from nail art to, you know, Batman or whatever. And Brutsch was a moderator of, you know, hundreds of these and had become this, you know, power user among power users and had relationships with the staff and the administrator and was very entrenched and kind of a celebrity on the site.
Yeah, I mean, he was almost kind of protected in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the administrators, you know, gave him awards and they all knew his real name and would have never told anybody. So, yeah, he was definitely tight with the staff.
How did you find his real name?
So he had this thing where he would, because he was such a controversial figure, you know, he was very beloved by a lot of people, but also hated. And whenever somebody in the community would get in trouble, there's a lot of drama on Reddit, he would kind of reach out to these people and take them under his wing. And, you know, over his career, he's reached out to a lot of people. And one of these people kind of got disenchanted with him and was kind of grossed out by his obsession with underage girls and just leaked me his name when I was writing about this subreddit he found called Jailbait, which was dedicated to kind of taking pictures off of teenage girls' Facebook profiles and posting them to this jailbait subreddit where, you know, 20,000 creepy guys were drooling over them.
Yeah, again, I mean, that wasn't some kind of like small little part of the site. It was huge.
Right. It was, yeah, it was for a while the second biggest search term that brought people to Reddit right after Reddit, and was kind of this cultural weird touchstone in a way on the site where, you know, everybody was like, oh, jailbait, you know, it was kind of this thing that people love to hate, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's go back to this name stuff, because this story is really, I mean, it's kind of taken over the internet for the last week or so. And most of the discussion has centered around your decision to publish the guy's name. So when did you find out his name?
It was, I think, probably almost exactly a year ago, probably October, November 2011, when his former friend gave me a bunch of screenshots and information that, you know, he said proved that this guy was Michael Brutsch. And at the time, he had never been, you know, given a voice interview. He'd given a lot of interviews, you know, over chat. He'd never appeared on camera or anything, so it was going to be very hard to kind of confirm that. You know, I didn't want to just call him up and him say, no, that's wrong, and me not be able to confirm it. And so I was trying to figure out, you know, he would go to meetups and stuff. And so I was like, well, I would have to track down, you know, everyone who had gone to a meetup with him and try to get them to ID him. And I was just like, oh, this is going to be a huge hassle. You know, like, it'll cause all this drama. You know, as soon as I ask somebody who is friendly with him, they'll tell him and he'll, you know, blow it up on Reddit, which ultimately did happen, you know, just a year later. So I was kind of putting it off. And then Jailbait, which was what I was writing about at the time, closed down because Anderson Cooper covered it and there was this huge outcry. And so it closed down. He kind of went underground for a while. I think that, you know, the administrators were kind of burned by Jailbait and had backed away from him. So it kind of seemed like he was done. Like, he was, you know, just kind of a non-entity anymore. But that wasn't really true, because he came back just, you know, a month ago and was moderating this subsection called Creep Shots, which was dedicated to voyeuristic snapshots of, like, women on the street posted without their consent. And, you know, it was all another, like, creepy sexual subreddit. And so he was brought on basically after all this controversy came up to moderate it. And so I was like, oh man, you know, he's back. Yeah. And he's still there. And I was like, I have this guy's identity. Creep Shots is like a pretty bad thing. And, you know, in the interim, he had been on a podcast using his real voice with a bunch of other Reddit people. And so I realized that I just had to call up this guy and, you know, compare his voice.
So the story was, it wasn't like you were working on something about Creep Shots. You knew the guy's name, and when Creep Shots came back, it was like, all right, fuck it, I'm doing this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had been writing about, like, the seedy side of Reddit for a long time, and so I was interested in him as a character, as, like, and just interested in, you know, the fact that he was this really awful guy who was, like, openly racist and sexist, but also, like, extremely powerful. And it definitely seemed like he was kind of the main guy behind a lot of the really bad stuff on Reddit. So I was always like, oh, this is an interesting guy.
You arranged, like, a chat with him, but then, like, tell me about that phone call. What was it like talking to the guy?
It was pretty awkward, because I hadn't been planning on calling him when I did, because I was just going to set up a chat with him and kind of ask him basic questions, you know, and get his response as Violent Acres. And then later, you know, maybe even a day later, call him, you know, call Michael Brutsch and be like, this is you, right? But while I was asking him all these questions, I was asking him a lot about anonymity, because, you know, that was kind of like the angle that I was looking at. I'm very interested in, like, how anonymity plays into these people's lives, you know, to what extent it kind of causes them to do all these horrible things. So I was asking him all these questions, like, oh, you know, well, why don't you tell anybody your name? And at the same time, I was like, but you're not very careful with your identity, because you go to all these meetups, and, you know, and then he kind of caught on that, like, he was like, do you have my name? I was like, I couldn't lie to him. So I was like, yeah. And then I panicked and I was like, oh, I really have to call him right now or else, you know, he might just shut off and like call him.
Or he can plan a defense.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I just picked up the phone right then and called him. And basically the conversation took off from exactly where we were chatting. You know, he was like, so are you going to out me? I call him up. I'm like, hey, Michael, you know, this is Adrian from Gawker. We're chatting right now. And he's like, oh, you know, so are you going to out me? And I was like, so that was.
Yeah. Where does that conversation rank on like your all time most awkward conversation?
Oh, definitely the most awkward. Yeah, really. I mean, it was definitely intense. You know, I've talked to some people, you know, confronted them about things that I've dug up, but that was by far the like most excruciating.
Did he beg forgiveness?
He begged me to not publish his name. I mean, he wasn't apologetic at all. He owned up to everything. He was, you know, he said, I stand by exactly what I've done. And was just kind of like, I have a disabled wife. I have a kid. I just like to rile up people. So, you know, don't do this. You're going to ruin my life, basically.
And what, did you, when you made that pitch, did you have any doubts? I mean, the whole plan of the story was to out the guy.
Right. No, I definitely had second thoughts. And, you know, he was like, so are you going to do it? And I said, you know, I don't know. The story's not done. And I really didn't know at that time because I was like, oh, man, I can't do it. Like, I can't, like, ruin this guy's life. And then, you know, I talked to a friend who was really kind of like, oh, you've got to do it because he's spent all of these years violating these girls' privacy. You know, and that was one thing that kind of made me more comfortable with it. But what really got me okay with it was thinking about, like, what if I wrote the story without putting his name in it? And it was like, I would basically be protecting him and, you know, kind of boosting his brand as Violent Acres, you know, kind of feeding right into what he wanted to do. And I couldn't just, I felt like I couldn't just write it and be like, oh, I know his name, but I'm not going to tell you. You know, it was just like,
yeah, you couldn't hold out once you had it. I mean, you certainly would have been a very weird story to publish without. I mean, the whole right. story is about finding out his name. And then
he, you know, he shut down his account right after I called him. And there was this big controversy on Reddit where he, you know, it got out that I was writing this story. And then I was like, I can't not publish it because, you know, I don't care really what he did. Like, it wasn't like my job to shut it down, but it was like, you know, it would have made it seem like the only thing I cared about was shutting down this section or this guy, when what I really wanted to do was like tell the story of him. So,
and in terms of that decision, I think people, our listeners, probably don't have a great sense of how Gawker works. I don't really have a great sense of how Gawker works. Mm-hmm. Like, were you making that decision with an editor? Is that something you guys are talking about?
Not, there wasn't a lot of discussion. I mean, I was just talking to Emma Carmichael, the managing editor, about it because AJ Delario, the editor-in-chief, was out of the office. And I was just keeping her up to date. I said, you know, right when I got off the phone, I think I was like, oh, I can't do this, you know. And then the next day, after I thought about it, I was like, I have to actually name him. And she was like, okay.
So she was kind of like, wasn't putting pressure on you one way or the other.
No.
If you decided not to do it, that would have been cool.
Yeah. I mean, I got the sense that it was like up to me what I wanted to do. So, and that's kind of how it works at Gawker. There's not a lot of, there's not a lot of, I guess, shaping or, you know, it's mostly like, are you not going to embarrass yourself? And, you know, is this actually something that is worth running?
You're sort of like an internet detective a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like you're interested in sort of like trying to solve these mysteries.
Yeah, I think I'm very interested in how, you know, information travels around the internet and how these like stories and rumors get formed and these kind of like internet lore. And so a lot of the time, the best way to tell the story of these is to tell how I, you know, found out about it, how I kind of got to the bottom of it, because it really shows like where the story comes from. You know, it's kind of like reverse engineering almost.
And has that always been a thing that you've been interested in? How did you get started doing these kinds of stories?
The first one that was kind of, I think, descended it, and in a very literal way, I think a lot of this stuff comes directly from this one story, is the story of Jesse Slaughter. I don't know if you know that, but this was a 14-year-old girl who, in the summer of 2010, a video went viral of her dad screaming at her web camera, basically at these like invisible tormentors, being like, you know, I'm gonna get you, I'm gonna, the money quote was like, I'm gonna backtrace you, which became a meme. There were like five or six memes spawned from this one video because it was so ridiculous. And you know, he had this like weird cowboy mustache, and it was just like a very strange Jerry Springer kind of thing. He had no idea what the internet was, really. And so this went crazy viral. But nobody really explained what was going on in it. It was just like this guy yelling at a webcam. And so I just like did, you know, maybe 2 hours of Googling and searching, and found out that there was actually this very long backstory where the girl had been the subject of all these rumors on this tween gossip blog called Sticky Drama. And she became this kind of like anti-hero in this weird teen internet cam girl world, and that she was like provoking all these people. And then somehow 4chan, message board 4chan, found out about it, and all of them started glomming onto this story and basically harassing her, and it got kind of out of control. And that video was her dad after, you know, 4chan had been hounding them for the past 3 or 4 days, like at the end of his rope, like yelling at the camera. And it was kind of, you know, this screwed up story that people were like just like making fun of because it was a silly video, but it was like a really kind of sad story of like this like girl who was just having her life ruined and ruining her own life by doing these crazy things. So yeah,
so you went like sort of track that one down, and then what happens next? How do you find the next one? Are people are people starting to like email you stuff that's like, this looks kind of crazy, this is some fake shit? Are you like just kind of glomming on stories that are kind of taking off, but no one's really asking how it happened?
Well, that was the first time I really dug into like 4chan and Anonymous, which is a lot of what I was writing.
Sorry, give us a sense of like when this is, when you're talking about.
This is summer of 2010, like that story basically. Because after that story, Anonymous and 4chan got mad at me because I kind of dug into how they were going after another person after Jesse Slaughter, kind of connected, you know, another character in this drama around Jesse Slaughter. They were going to troll him and report him for, you know, pedophilia and make up all these like police reports and stuff. And I was in the chat room just writing down what they were doing to screw up this guy's life. And I wrote a post about it, and 4chan got really mad about that. And there was all this drama where they attacked Gawker. They brought down our website. You know, we were writing about this at the time. And so that was kind of like a very, you know, instructive introduction to 4chan and Anonymous. And that actually eventually led to Gawker being hacked in the summer, or I guess the fall of 2011. I mean, it was pretty much directly descended from that. But through that, you know, this kind of underworld of internet culture was something that I was very interested in after that. And there was just like a lot of stories that were there.
Walk us through kind of like what your rhythms are like. I mean, you're sort of doing these longer stories kind of when they come up, but you're also writing posts during the week. How do you balance the sort of like shorter stuff with these longer pieces? How does that work at Gawker?
Yeah, it's changed a lot. I've been there for 3 years, and it's changed a lot since I've been there. I mean, when I was starting, I was doing, you know, 4 to 6 posts a day at least. And so there wasn't a lot of opportunity to do longer things. But since AJ took over about a year ago, he's really opened it up to doing longer things. And so there's no quota. You know, when I was working on that Violent Acres piece, I went for a week and a half without writing anything. So I think I have a lot of freedom to just take my time now.
What's the theory behind that? I mean, from a sort of business model sense, what's that approach about?
I think that he, I mean, I think he realizes that if we have writers, you know, writing what they care about and putting effort into a fewer number of things, it will give greater dividends than just churning out, you know, kind of high traffic link bait. And we also have this guy, Nitsan, who's like an amazing aggregator and, you know, just totally on top of everything that's coming out of the internet. And so that gives everybody else like freedom to do these longer pieces.
And I mean, it seems like at least from a traffic perspective, it's kind of paying off. I mean, I assume the Violent Acre story is the numbers have to be off the charts.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely going to be my most popular story ever, I think. And so yeah, you know, I spent a week and a half without putting anything up, but it definitely pays back. And you know, we operate by a uniques. That's kind of the main metric that we use. And so those bigger, longer stories bring in, I think, more uniques than, you know, even like a big short post.
So this story you just posted is getting, you know, coverage on CNN. You've been doing interviews on NPR, and it's getting all of this attention. It's getting the level of attention that most magazine writers would kill for. How do you see your work in sort of in the context of sort of traditional long form magazine journalism?
I don't know. I've never written like a magazine feature, so it's almost like it's similar in that I try to, you know, bring in the bigger issues and not just, you know, be funny or tell a sensational story. But I think it's also kind of rough and sketchy in a way that I think blog posts are. You know, a lot of it is kind of like, I feel like long form blog writing almost. It's just like, you know, I don't spend a lot of time editing or, you know, looking it over. It's like just type as fast as you can and kind of try to cram all of your research in, and then it goes up.
And that research is another thing I want to ask you about. I mean, a couple of magazine writers, after your story came out on Friday and it was getting passed around everywhere, and, you know, we posted it on long form, it was getting read by a whole bunch of people, especially for something posted at 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of magazine writers who started knocking it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Chris Jones, who we had on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, sent something out. I think he called it as airtight as a screen door, I think.
Chris Jones has some beef with Gawker, though, so.
All right, well, we'll take Chris Jones out of it. But I did see some other stuff where people kind of people who do traditional magazine reporting, where they're like flying somewhere, spending a lot of time with someone, like reporting things from all sides, were kind of saying like, this is a great story, and it didn't get the full treatment.
Right. I would totally agree with that. I mean, you know, I'm bound by the limitations of Gawker and also the internet. I mean, I guess the ideal way to report it would have definitely been to go down there and kind of like stake him out, you know, which would have been awesome, and I would have loved to do it, but it's like, that's not gonna happen. And by the time I, you know, contacted him, things exploded so quickly that I was kind of like, gotta get it out of the door. But I would have loved to, you know, talk to his family, his, you know, whoever I could have. But a lot of the stuff that I do is kind of limited by, you know, who I can access just by like Googling and calling. So it's like, yeah.
It's also peculiar to the stuff that you're writing about, because you're writing about the internet, and the internet doesn't stop and wait for like a monthly publication cycle. Like, the story's evolving as you're doing it, which was a premium on sort of getting the stuff out there as fast as you can. Do you have aspirations to like do longer stuff? Like maybe come back to this story and tell it in full or report it out?
Yeah, I would love to. I would love to do something like that. I mean, I would love to do kind of a bigger take on a lot of the stories that I was writing about. But a lot of them are just, yeah, I think are very situated. I mean, it's kind of, like I said, like long form blogging. I don't think that any of my pieces would really hold up in a magazine, you know, whether it's just because of time or, you know, we have kind of a different standard of, you know, proof, or, you know, I can report rumors. I can just tell a story, as opposed to, you know, having to get every angle of it. So, so that's why I kind of like think it's different than writing a magazine story, and can't really be compared to that.
Tell us about the Horsey book story for a little bit. How long was that? Like, how long were you working on that?
That one was kind of interesting because it really just took like 2 days to track him down. Horse eBooks is like this spam robot that probably a lot of people listening to the podcast know about, because it's kind of blown up, but it just finds all of these snippets of text and will put them out onto Twitter kind of as a spam evasion technique, but it's advertising these like eBooks that have to do with horses and gain this cult following for being like this weird found poetry. And nobody really knew who was behind it. And I was just kind of wondering, like, how hard would it be to actually find this guy? Because it was like, the only rumor was that he was like a Russian, you know, a Russian guy who had set up this spam bot. And I think a lot of people thought he was some kind of like shady organized crime, you know, hacker dude.
Yeah, most organized crime dudes are really into found poetry.
Right, right. Who had just like, yeah, set this up. Like some guy, Boris, was like, you know... doing this in between selling Viagra and, you know, walking around with its like blonde wife or something. And so I was just like, who is this guy actually? And, you know, I sat down and just Googled for like hours on a Saturday. I was just like, I don't know what made me think that I wanted to do this weekend, but I was like, all right, this weekend I'm going to like find who this is. And so I just sat down, and, you know, it just took like a long time and a lot of different ways to search Google, and eventually having to buy like pay $20 to see, you know, if this person had registered a website, what other websites did they own? And that's kind of ultimately what led me to him, because he had registered the Horse eBooks website, but also dozens of other ones. And one of them happened to be his web design firm. And so through that, I was able to get at him.
And then he didn't even end up talking to you, right?
No, he didn't talk to me. He remains mysterious Alexei. He would only communicate with me through this American who he had done web design work for, an American realtor who does like Bahamas realty. And so he would only communicate through that, and he wouldn't comment on it at all. But you know, the his American friend said he's really nice. And I've been emailing with him through this guy since then, trying to get him to do an interview. And I actually just emailed last week, and the guy was like, you know, can you promote his web design service in your interview? And I said, yeah, I'll do anything, you know, basically.
Like, that'll be the headline.
Whatever he wants, yeah. But then he comes back to me and says, well, Alexei says he promised his client he wouldn't talk about this in the media. And so that adds another layer, because it's actually not this guy, it's he's doing it for somebody who he's employed by.
Boris.
Yeah.
The guy with the blonde wife. Yeah, organized,
so maybe
crime.
There is. Maybe it's, yeah, maybe it's somebody high up. But, yeah.
Tell the people about Goatsy.
Well, I should just tell people to Google it. And
yeah, actually.
Just Google
actually, you know it. What? Yeah. Just search it, and you'll see for yourself.
So Goatsy is like the grossest internet meme ever. It's just a guy pulling his ass open, and it's become like this legendary geek, you know, urban legend, basically. Yeah. And so I was just very curious, like, who the guy was, because there were a lot of rumors out there, like, about who he was. You know, there was a name out there even, and, you know, there were rumors that he had died, just a lot of speculation. And so I kind of, like, went through all the rumors and also traced kind of how it became such a big phenomenon on the internet.
How often do you go down these paths and come up with nothing? Like, how often do you go down, like, crazy Google holes, mm-hmm. and whatever you're looking for isn't
like
there?
Every day, basically. Multiple times every day. I mean, I just, like, go to just, like, crazy, you know, I want to someday just, like, publish a list of all the forums that I've joined. Just, like, really insane, weird, you know, just, like, every interest, you know. I'm just, like, a lot of the stuff that I get comes from like forums or like kind of overlooked corners of the internet. And so, yeah, just sign up for thousands of forums. I follow all these Twitter accounts. You know, I think Twitter is where I get a lot of really good ideas, because it's like you can really easily like get into a world and just see what's going on there, because they're all people are talking just like as if nobody's listening. You know, like if you find like a world where people are into it and follow all these Twitter accounts, you can basically get a pretty good sense of what's going on.
And how often does that reporting, I mean, how often do you actually go offline once you've gotten somewhere? How often are you meeting these people?
Hardly ever. I did a lot of Occupy Wall Street reporting, which I did a lot of it in person, and that was really cool because I, you know, hardly ever get to do that. But
is that something you want to do more of?
Oh yeah, totally. I'd love to do. I mean, I really like the internet beat and all this stuff, and every time I get kind of bored of it, something else, like, you know, I was feeling like pretty burnt out on all this stuff, and then this happened, which was just like kind of a next level like weirdness. But you know, I was covering Anonymous for like a year, and I was just like really sick. I was like, I never want to cover any other leak or hack again. It's so boring, and
the leaks and hacks keep coming, man. Yeah.
But all these guys are like full of shit, you know, and they're all the interesting ones are arrested. But then, yeah. And so eventually I'd love to do like more kind of like real, I mean, you know, all these people are real people. And, I think a lot of it would just be a matter of, you know, visiting them and seeing how they actually live and what their lives are like off of the internet.
Yeah. I mean, I that's one of the experiences I have when I'm reading your stuff is, it seems like it always gets really close to that.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, especially with like Violent Acres, you know, it your story sort of hints at the kind of, there is some kind of like twisted sympathetic side of him that also came out in the last week. I mean, he had a ton of support mostly on Reddit, but a lot of people kind of came right to back him, but there's also this hint, and I think you sort of refer to this directly in the story, that he's as big a fucking asshole in real life as he is on the site. Which is often not true of trolls.
Right. One of my main goals in that piece, outside of just showing what was going on, was also just kind of breaking down the idea that like trolls are just completely divorced from, you know, who they are in real life, which I think really gets played up a lot of times, especially in like cyberbullying cases or something. It's like this, you know, mild mannered teen turned into a monster and bullied somebody to suicide. You know, it's like not actually true.
Right. Like in this case, the guy was actually the guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you had any further communication with him this week? Have you guys talked anymore?
No, I tried to email him a couple times. I don't think he's going to talk to me. Although, you know, I've been following him because now he's posting on under his real name on Reddit and kind of updating people. And people keep on asking him, you know, are you going to get Chen? Are you going to get Gawker? And he's basically, you know, very reasonably saying that, well, he's just doing his job. It's all on me. You know, I was playing a game and I lost. I brought this on myself. You know, Gawker is not on my mind anymore. So I think that's where he's at.
But Gawker's on other people's mind. I mean, part of what's interesting about these stories is that people respond to the site as much as you.
Right.
Gawker's actually, like, you know, taking some punches after these stories, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Gawker is a controversial site, and so whenever anybody has a problem with whatever I'm doing, that's kind of what they'll fall back on is, oh, it's Gawker, you know. Here's a laundry list of things that they did that, you know, are controversial. And so, you know, that doesn't really bother me. I mean, I'm happy to let the work stand. And if people want to just bash Gawker or whatever.
Well, there's bashing Gawker, but there's also attacking Gawker.
Right.
Which people have done.
Are you talking about when 4chan attacked Gawker?
You know what? Adrian, I am.
Yes. So after I wrote about, after I wrote about Jesse Slaughter, 4chan attacked us and brought down our website for a bit. And that was kind of just a, you know, interesting bit of like drama in the summer that people were very thrilled about on the internet, I think. But that kind of ultimately led to some really elite hackers getting our scent and trying to dig into us and ultimately hacking us and leaking all of our users' names and passwords. And it was a huge debacle that, you know, probably occupied 2 or 3 months of, you know, Nick Denton and the tech team's time. And
so you just like walk in every day with like a hat, like real low over your eyes.
Well,
big, it was, big beards and such.
I was just kind of, you know, when the smaller attack was happening, you know, everybody was kind of happy about it because it was just like they came out looking bad, and you know, I just kind of tried to rationalize that this was like just, you know, the inevitable fallout from that. But the team that actually, and this is something that kind of has gotten lost in history, but the team that attacked us was the team that would go on to become Lulzsec, which was like this superstar hacker group, part of Anonymous, that hacked the FBI and, you know, brought down the CIA's website. But their first hack was Gawker.
You were the inspiration.
Basically, yeah. It was pretty weird. And then I ended up reporting a lot on Lulzsec, and so it's very strange how everything comes back on us. But I will never forget the day that we got hacked because I was actually working. It was Sunday. I was a weekend editor at the time in November 2010, I think. It was like Sunday evening. I was at Cafe Grumpy in Greenpoint. And like the day before, Gizmodo's Twitter had been hacked. And, you know, this was Saturday, so I was the only one working. And I emailed tech and I emailed, you know, some people. And they were like, oh, you know, somebody got our passwords. Not a big deal. Don't worry about it. So I was like, okay, went on. And then, you know, Sunday evening, it's probably 5, I'm about to finish up for the day, and all of a sudden, like, locked out of our content management system, and then a post goes up on under my name with this, like, you know, meme image, and it's just like, Gnosis has hacked Gawker, like, you know, all of this stuff, and I had to like tweet out like, that's not me, like, we're hacked. And it was just like a crazy, you know, free for all after that. I was like in Anonymous chat rooms trying to figure out what was going on.
And you were like totally flying solo, couldn't get anyone on the phone?
Oh, well, you know, people came on, but there wasn't anything we could do. And yeah, I mean, for the first, you know, half hour or something, I was on my own. But I did get a lot of Twitter followers that day because, you know, everybody who cared about Gawker, right, or media or, you know, the internet, would, like, I was the only one tweeting about it. So,
I'm asking all these questions about magazine stuff, pigeonholing you as a Gawker blogger. And, you're actually part of a pretty amazing magazine.
Yes.
Tell me about the New Inquiry.
Well, the New Inquiry is a journal of, essays and reviews. It's online only. We have kind of a PDF edition, but everything is published online eventually. Newinquiry.com. Just check it out. It's thenewinquiry.com. I always get screwed up. But yeah, it's
how much do you hate those people who have newinquiry.com?
it's just like a splat. It's like a, you know, holding site, which is even worse. It's like, what are you doing with it?
Yeah, there's
a nonprofit, so they should give it to us.
Someone is squatting on longform.com, and I keep like emailing them from like increasingly ludicrous Gmail accounts to ask about the price, and the price keeps going up, which I feel like is like a good sign for how the site is doing, but it's really fucking annoying.
Who was the domain squatter who was like, long-form journalism is going to be the...
It's coming. I'm betting on long-form. I'm not going to do anything, but I'm betting on it.
The next sex.com. Yeah. Sex.com and longform.org or longform.com.
I think I probably shouldn't say this out loud. I'm pretty sure we own longporn.org.
Longporn.org.
That's like the real business.
Really? Well, I write a lot about the porn industry, so maybe you can do like a long form porn.
Yeah, we can do some offshoot. We can do some sort of like co promoted story. Anyway, man, New Inquiry. Tell me about the New Inquiry.
So it's just it's a really crazy group of people, a lot of young people, a lot of kind of not established writers or you know, bloggers that have been just kind of come together through similar interests or styles. And actually, the way that I got involved in the New Inquiry is a weird story. I was covering Occupy Wall Street, and one of my sources was this guy named Malcolm Harris, who was a writer for this other magazine called Jacobin. And he tipped me off to the fact that Radiohead was going to be playing down at Zuccotti Park. I wrote a post about it. It was like a big, you know, to-do at the time. And it turned out that that was a prank, that Radiohead was never supposed to show up. Somebody had pretended to be their manager to them. And, you know, I talked to Malcolm. He's like, oh, you know, I got pranked. But then I was at a New Inquiry event and saw him again. You know, we had both had a few drinks, and he admitted to me that he was actually the guy who had pranked both the Occupy Wall Street like media team by pretending to be their manager, and also me by tipping me off. So I had reported kind of a false rumor that had been.
And you were like, I'm about to write 5,000 words about your ass.
Right, right. And so after that, I was like, yeah, you know, you got to like either write something for us or I'm going to write about it. And so he wrote a post about it, and he's one of the editors. He's like the, you know, a senior editor there who's kind of now more well known for being the guy who Twitter, the DA is trying to get Twitter to hand over his deleted messages. So
right.
That's kind of how I got into it. And it kind of shows you, you know, the weird kind of network. It's a very decentralized, like, you know, kind of an Occupy like structure.
What are you working on now?
I don't know right now. I mean, I was kind of interested in, so since this whole Michael Brutsch thing happened, I have been accused a lot of doxing him, which is this hacker term for you just publish somebody's private information to basically intimidate them. Usually it's like a dossier of, you know, their name, their street address, their phone number, maybe their family's information. And so I'm kind of interested in that phenomenon because it really goes back like a long ways to like the early 90s and like the hacker scene. And I think it's becoming more prevalent, you know, outside of just hackers. I mean, just like kids will do it to each other to like piss each other off, you know? And so I think I'm going to try to do like a longer story about that.
About like that phenomenon?
Just the culture around it. There are whole websites where like people will post docs of, you know, rival hackers. And, you know, once you're docs, you're kind of like cowed because you can't do anything illegal anymore, you know? And there are also people who, from what I understand, are like paid to like dox other people. You know, it's just like a whole, you know, kind of wraps up into the privacy issues as well.
Do you ever like, do you ever worry about fucking with these people who seem to spend like most of their time trying to fuck with people?
Yeah, I got pretty paranoid after the Gawker hack. And I was actually doxxed. That's another reason why I kind of am interested in this, because the first time they attacked us, they doxxed me, although most of the information was wrong, but they posted it to 4chan and was like, harass this guy. And I got a few phone calls, but one thing that actually happened was they sent a bunch of prepaid postal boxes. That's one of their tactics, is just to flood you with these free boxes that the postal service will send. And they sent a bunch of them to this random Chinese woman in Queens, thinking that that was my address. And I actually got an email like a month later from her being like, I got all of these boxes. I don't know how she found me, but she's like, these are
fuck you, other yeah, Adrian Chen.
Yeah, she was like, I think somebody sent you all these boxes. Like, what do you want to do with them? And I just never emailed her back because I was like, I don't know how to explain. I'd have to explain, like, you know, basically what we've talked about in this podcast to her, to tell her.
I mean, are you on edge about this stuff? I mean, you're kind of like a public enemy number one on Reddit right now.
Yeah.
Like,
are
you thinking about that? Is that in the back of your head?
Yeah, I definitely take precautions. I mean, I have like two-factor authentication on my Gmail, which is kind of what I'm worried about the most, is like somebody hacking my Gmail. But somebody was like trying to pretending to be me on Facebook the other day. But I don't know, nothing's happened. The worst that could happen is like my Twitter or Facebook was hacked, and you know, it's not that big of a deal, I don't think. But I'm not worried about like somebody coming to my house or like, yeah.
You have no like offline concerns?
IRL. No, yeah. I'm not worried about IRL trolling.
Good, man. I'm glad. I was worried about it for you, but now I'm not. Adrian, man, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been great.
Thanks for having me.
Don't watch your back, because you don't even need to worry about it. I'm Max Linsky. Thanks for listening to Longform. My co-hosts are Evan Ratliff and Aaron Lammer. It's edited by Lauren Kirchner. Thanks very much to Tiny Letter, our wonderful sponsor. We'll be back next week.